that right, but...
Well,
that's fine, but I'll, I got ways I can...
You want to do your goal?
Yeah, just let Kevin know, he can keep talking. Good morning, I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for Friday, March 9, 2007. We obviously do not have a quorum, but on the other hand, we're not going to be taking final action on any of the bills here today. Next week, we do have to put together our budget division bill. Just as a caution, and it is public information right now, for the targets came out, I believe, yesterday, and assigned each budget division how much money they can spend over the base. That is, you know, every agency is already funded, and then if you're going to go over that, they've been told what they have. Mine is the only budget division that got a cut to the tune of $10 million. So prospects for a lot of new initiatives are not looking very good right now. And those numbers are not going to change. I mean, those have been released. That's what we've been assigned to, and that's what I have to work with, and my bill has to be done next week. But we do have some bills on the agenda. We will be hearing the proposals here. As I say, we're not going to take final action on anything today. We will have the list of bills next week as we put together a bill together. Now, as you can see, we do have a rather long agenda. What my policy is, I just kind of allocate the time we've got available, figure out how many bills. If there's a bill that clearly needs additional time, we will provide it. But roughly, I'm looking for a total of 10 minutes per bill. That doesn't necessarily mean 10 minutes of testimony, because if you give 10 minutes of testimony, we have no time for answer any questions. You know, we may have to, you know, just end it right there. If anybody really, 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 really feels that you have much longer time that you've got to have, and you must spend more time explaining your bill, please pass a note up. Let me know. I will put you at the end of the agenda. And then you can have whatever time you want when we get to you. But please be cognizant that we do have a long agenda, and we do need people to get to the point and explain what the bill does and what you're seeking here. I don't have any authors in here at the moment, so Senator Olsen, would you chair? And I'm going to take up one or two of my bills. It's your turn.
Give me that gavel.
And if Sharon comes in, then we will go to her.
I'm stuck here. It's a pretty good excuse, huh?
Mr. Chair, let's do Senate File 1679, the Secretary of State's appropriation. And I do have the Secretary of State here, Mark Ritchie, and I will turn it over to him to explain the bill.
Okay. Welcome to the State Government Budget Committee, and state your name.
Senator Sharon just walked in, and she's in on another committee, but you stay here because it's your bill, too.
Yes.
So let's switch places, and I'll have Senator Sharon go to Senate File 208.
That was short.
Okay?
Well, missed the opportunity.
Okay. Were we just getting started?
Yes.
Yes. We're going to go back to Senate File 208, and Senator Olsen, if you do need to go downstairs for roll call vote, feel free to do so. We can. Senator Sharon, welcome to the Budget Division, and you have Senate File 208. This is the where's my agenda? The absentee voting process simplification, and you have the Secretary of State with you.
Yes, I do. Yeah. Thank you very much, Chairman. Happy to be here with your committee on Senate File 2008, the absentee ballot bill. I would be happy to go through the bill with you if that would be helpful.
Why don't you explain what you're going to do, and then have your witnesses also testify as to what you need to be accomplishing here.
Okay, thank you very much. I would like you to have a look at the bill that you should receive 2008, or bill Senate File number 208. Which authorizes any eligible voter to vote by absentee ballot. It strikes the specific reasons why a voter has to, which is now in legislation, that they have to give for being able to vote by absentee ballot. It strikes from the absentee ballot application any reference to the reason the voter will be stating as to why they are unable to vote in person in the polling place on election day. And it permits a voter who has requested status as an ongoing absentee voter to receive an absentee ballot rather than just absentee ballot application for each election, unless the voter declines to receive an absentee ballot for one or more elections. And that's done by notifying the county auditor or the municipal clerk at least 5 days before the deadline for absentee ballots. It requires the Secretary of State to adopt rules governing ongoing absentee voters. It authorizes the county auditor and the municipal clerk to deliver an absentee ballot to an agent designated under Section 6 of the bill of a voter who would have difficulty getting to the polls because of health reasons or disability, or who's a resident of a facility providing assisted living services. So this is a delivery process by a designated agent to deliver a ballot. And it limits the requirements that an absentee ballot be witnessed by another registered Minnesota voter or by a notary public to a ballot cast by an individual not previously registered to vote. And 6 authorizes a voter who would have difficulty getting to the polls because of health reasons or who is a resident of a facility providing assisted living services, etc., to designate an agent who would deliver the ballots to the voter as long as they're returned by 3 o'clock on election day. And that's a summation of the vote of the bill for the committee.
And did the secretary wish to testify that as well too? Welcome to the budget division again. Please identify yourself for the record, Mr. Ritchie.
My name is Mark Ritchie, Secretary of State. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe that adequately and carefully covers the main provisions of the bill. Thank you.
Okay. I'm familiar with the bill because I did hear it in the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee. Cyril C., did you have any questions on the bill?
Yeah, the only concerns I had heard would be if somebody else was handling the, like a mail-in ballot or something, why it just couldn't be mailed and why somebody might have to have somebody deliver it for them.
Is there somebody wish?
Mr. Okay. Chair, I'm Beth Fraser with the Secretary of State's office. Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, the agent delivery provision is currently in place for people who are in healthcare facilities, battered women shelters, or group homes, people who would have trouble getting to the polling place. We currently allow them to designate someone to go to the county auditor's office and pick up an absentee ballot, bring it to them, and then bring it back to the office. What this does is it expands it for people in people who would have trouble because they're sick at home. We sometimes got calls from people who said, my mom has pneumonia. How can I get her a ballot? And the only answer is, well, get her to the hospital, and then you're allowed to go pick up a ballot for her, which doesn't seem to be the right answer, especially with healthcare costs these days. It would also allow for assisted living facilities, those who live there, because currently they're not covered under the definition of healthcare facility. And it would allow, similarly, for people who are disabled to have it, to designate an agent. That's what this provision does.
Thank you. That's the only concern I had heard.
And this appears to have a fiscal impact of $123,000 in fiscal year 08. Okay. Is there anybody here who wants to be heard on Senate File 208? Again, we're looking at the fiscal implications of this bill. There appears to be none. I will then lay the bill over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill then.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. At the end of the hearing on Wednesday, we had just finished Senator Roebling's bill. She's not here yet, but this was Senate File 801, which was the governor's state government budget proposals. I did indicate that if we ran out of time, there was no opportunity for anybody to have any public testimony on that. If anybody is here who wanted to testify on that, please let me know. Again, Senator Roebling's not here, so we'd have to defer any discussion on that until she does arrive. if there is nobody here, then we, you know, we'll just proceed obviously through the agenda. But I'm just looking around. Is there anybody who did show up specifically on Senate File 801, the governor's bill? I don't see anybody, so we will not be taking any further action on that today. Then, so thank you. Okay, Senator Olsen, if you would assume the chair here, so I can present Senate File 1679.
Welcome, Senator Betzel and Secretary of State Ritchie.
And again, Mr. Chair, as we indicated a moment ago, this is the request of the Secretary of State that actually goes above what the governor's recommendations were. I did ask that the departments and agencies who had an interest in funding additional initiatives present bills to this budget division. And that is what this bill does that I've introduced on behalf of the Secretary of State. So, as I say, I will defer to the Secretary of State for further discussion of this proposal.
Thank you. Secretary, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. This bill is a combination of things that would be one-time expenditures and some which are ongoing. So let me go from the top to the bottom. Based on the bill that you have in front of you. The first is appropriation of $50,000 for the operation of a statewide task force to look at instant runoff voting or ranked voting to begin exploring what are the implications for state election law and for standardized procedures as cities and towns, and in some cases townships and school boards, move towards this system of ranked voting. And so this is for the operations of that task force. The next item is website improvement. As our agency has become more and more 24-hour a day, 7-day a week available through the website, it's become clear that this is a very central service. Citizens are making heavy use. 55 million hits on our website a year now. We need a person who's responsible for the overall maintenance and improvement of that website, and it's built into this change request above the governor's baseline budget. The third item, the Office of Secretary of State is responsible every 2 years for publishing what we call the Blue Book or the Legislative Manual. There's been a great expansion this year in the number of demands on the kinds of information that people want and the presentation. And also, there's a kind of modernization where many libraries want a CD-ROM version. There's, of course, great savings in terms of not printing, but there are additional costs that come from the production of a CD-ROM or web-based version of what's now currently a printed book. We're asking for an additional appropriation of $50,000 in each biennium. We do it every 2 years to be able to produce this book as people would like it, and also to produce the CD-ROM and online version of the book. The next item is business services, and this is actually there are two parts to this subdivision. One is that there were four positions in business services eliminated. We're asking for the restoration of three of them. They have to do with the provision of services as the business community has been asking for, and we've been providing. People expect and demand very fast turnaround on business filings, often for the purposes of meeting their business obligations. They need very fast turnaround, and also we're having increasing demands from citizens who need specific kind of services that we provide. But the main demand has been that we continue to improve and make online our services that are now only available in person or through the mail. We have met now with many of our stakeholders, large law firms, businesses, organizations like John Deere and others who make heavy use of our services. Some of them are beginning to move their business filings to other states who've gone totally online, Colorado, North Carolina, there are a number of states. And there's an expectation that in Minnesota that we stay ahead of the curve, and it's what we want to do in our office. But to do that, we need to continue to transform our business services to being available totally online, again, 24/7 to our customers. This will eventually reduce the cost of staffing because people will be filing themselves. And this will eventually help us retain customers, businesses in Minnesota who are now making filings in other states. But we believe this is also the direction that we are going in our state. And we want to be able to make sure that the services we offer are what our businesses, our nonprofits, our other organizations are really looking for. And I want to note that in that section, it's a very large request, but it's largely for one time the incorporation of improvements in the website itself and in the offering of those services through software development. The next item, Safe at Home, this is an initiative passed by the legislature in the last session. It's a program that is now in 23 other states where offices of Secretary of State, sometimes another agency, provides a service where people who fear for their safety and whose location of where they live and must be kept secret use the Office of Secretary of State as a mail transfer point so that on their driver's license and in registering in certain public and private places, their address is a central address. Mail and other important documents come to that address, and then they are forwarded to their actual home address, but it's done with high confidentiality and a great deal of security. It's a privacy and it's a safety matter. We're working closely with the Department of Public Safety on this, and this appropriation is to meet the deadline and the expectations set by the legislature for our office to implement this program. This would be an ongoing expense. Subdivision 7, the Help America Vote Act, this is an authorization for the use of the federal money, the interest that has been earned on, and the residual in the accounts from federal money authorized under the Help America Vote Act. I might note that the actual number is $2,684,000, and these bills will not be considered today, but laid over. We want to make a correction on that. There is some adjustment because interest is being earned, so the actual number is $2,684,000. But these funds would be used for the items spelled out in the fiscal note that's attached. A certain amount of it is for upgrading the statewide voter registration database, the SVRS. But all those expenditures are ones that are strictly authorized under the federal legislation. It cannot be used for things not authorized. So this would be for the purposes of implementing that federal law. And it is federal money and interest earned on that money. Subdivision 8 is the use of the balance in that account. We are looking to see exactly what will be the available amount of money after the expenditures are done. And we will be having specific items in the change change request that specify what that would be for. The Help America Vote Act money in the past has been used primarily to help counties, townships, and cities to upgrade equipment and to make changes in their voting procedures to meet the federal requirements for disability accessible equipment and for standardization and for equal access. But it also authorizes the use of the money to improve our voter registration system, and that's the main focus that we will have with this money. That's the quick summary of this, Mr. Chairman. I'd be very happy to take any questions. Thank you again.
Mr. Chairman, we probably should correct or put the bill in the shape that it needs to be in, because if we're going to be considered down the road, we need the right numbers before us. So I believe on page 2, line 4, after the head note, Help America Vote Act, there's a number, $3 million for... $400,000. Anyway, that number should be $2,684,000. $2,684,000. That's the number that should be. So I would move that amendment to the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All those in favor of
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do we have a quorum?
Oh, we do not yet. I'm sorry. We do not yet. That's
noted.
No, we can't take any action on it. We'll as soon as we establish a quorum, we'll do that. Thank you, Senator Limmer. I had announced that we did not have a quorum. I think we're still one short, are we not? Yeah, okay. So thank you very much. No, we'll hold off on that. Let me ask, and we'll correct that when we get a that part when we get a quorum. One of the things I need to double check, which of these are one-time money? I had the web upgrade. Are there others that are one-time as opposed to ongoing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, we are now actually going through one by one because some have been combined. But, for example, in the business services, the major upgrades on the website and the programming, the bulk of it would be one time. The instant runoff voting task force would be one time. The website improvements, again, one time. The legislative manual is every 2 years. So this is Safe at Home is ongoing. And the HABA money, of course, is the federal money, and it's, in a sense, sort of one time in that regard.
Thank you.
Mr. Secretary, I had a question on under business services when you said most of the money is to develop software. I'm wondering if your hardware is sufficient for this upgrade.
Mr. Chairman, I think I would have been more accurate to say that it is that a bulk of that money is to develop the system for making the rest of our business services 24/7. The software portion is the most complicated and expensive, but obviously once we make those services available, citizens will use them and we will need to increase. And we've been in a very productive conversation with Office of Enterprise Technology, which is the statewide enterprise, and I feel very confident about kind of an evolution of our system to be able to handle what we expect to be a very large increase in citizen use. And so thank you for expanding on that point.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Ritchie, I was wondering if you could tell me, on page 2, you make reference to Safe at Home legislation. Is that a term that we use that's already established in law? It makes reference to the Safe at Home legislation, and I'm not familiar with what Safe at Home legislation is. Could you tell me what that reference is about?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer. In the last legislative session, a bill was passed. Safe at Home is the only way I've ever heard it referred to, and I could get the specific Senate and House file numbers. But Safe at Home is the name that I believe in Minnesota we've adopted to describe this program, as it was spelled out in the legislation. And again, it's mostly a crossing point where I have one of our experts on this legislation who was one of the key people helping to pass it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carla Ferrucci, and I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. And this is the term, the Safe at Home term, Senator Limmer, is really just an address confidentiality program. That's all it is, and I think that's just the term that we used to describe it. It's sort of like a layman's term, but it is an address confidentiality program.
Mr. Chair, perhaps in order to clarify this, perhaps as we continue with this legislation, you may want to specify, at least in capital letters or a reference to a state statute, what Safe at Home legislation is.
Great.
Usually we don't refer to just legislation. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's a bill turned into law. And so I think there should be a reference to a state statute rather than the term legislation. But Senator Betzel.
And I think Mr. Bodern was just looking up the session laws from last year. I don't know if he's found it yet. So.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, absolutely. Thank you very much for that suggestion.
One other quick question that I did have, Mr. Chair, is going to lines, page 1, lines 7 through 9, we make reference to an instant runoff voting task force. Has the legislature had any votes on whether or not we see this as a direction that the state wants to go? And if not, then the question is, why are we appropriating money for something that we haven't given an indication of whether we want to pursue that or not.
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lemert, to my knowledge, the legislature has not taken a position on this. What's occurring is that cities and, in some cases, smaller towns are beginning to move and to adopt this as a method of elections for their municipal elections. And the concern that's been raised by county auditors, city clerks, and others is that if everyone goes off and does their own thing, then we're going to have a kind of a mishmash around the state of different approaches, different standards, different ways of doing this. And at some point, state and election law needs to be considered in how they do it, but also the procedures in which they move forward. Minneapolis has adopted this. They are embedded within the Hennepin County system, and so they need to know that there's going to be a logic to how we proceed. So this this proposal came from the election officials, the county auditors, and the city clerks brought this to us, and they want to make sure that as they move forward, according to how their citizens decide, that there's a statewide continuity, so that, that there is a kind of, that there's a consistency statewide to it.
Mr. Chair, different political subdivisions handle elections in different ways. Sometimes they don't, as you know, they don't hold all their elections on the same election day. Sometimes they don't even have them on the same election year. If we would pursue that same logic, or is it that the desire of your office to bring even more continuity to Minnesota's election system of having it all on the same day, all on the same year. Every 2 or 4 years, we just have one grand election day for every political subdivision, to as far as pursuing the interests of continuity.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I'm not in favor of the centralization and consolidation of election times, and I've been pretty clear about that and have been a pretty strong defender. We have Township Day coming up next week, and this is a very important day in the life of townships, and many townships want to hold their election on that day, and I've been a strong defender of that approach. I have to say that in my experience, people do want to know the big picture. And the thing about instant runoff voting or ranked voting is that the big picture is a lot more complicated than the bumper strip that describes it in the course of a vote. And so my hope in gathering this information, as was requested of our office by the auditors, is not so much that we end up with a kind of one-size-fits-all system, but that we explain to election officials and to voters just how complicated and how complex this is. And I think doing a good job of exploring this will give people a more rational and perhaps a more cautious approach as if they decide to move down this direction, what it might look like.
Members, we now have a quorum. So was there any other correction, Senator Betzel?
Well, Mr. Chair, since we do have a quorum, I'll move that on page 2, line 4, the number 3,004,000 be deleted, and the number inserted $2,684,000.
I believe there might be another change.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, there's one other technical item. Senator Limmer referred to the reference to the Safe at Home legislation. I did find that you could, on page 2, line 2, delete the Safe at Home legislation and insert Minnesota Statutes Chapter 5B.
5B. I'll move that correction as well, too, Mr. Chair.
Okay. With those changes, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
Was opposed?
Secretary Ritchie, I had one last question, and that was, again, under business services. With all this technology and improvement in the services rendered, will there be additional fees paid to the state for those services so that's almost a revenue component?
Mr. Chairman, that's not anticipated by our office, but of course it is the prerogative of the legislature to adjust fees. What we've been saying in our discussion is that we need to have an overall analysis of our fees, because our partners at the county level are affected by our decision about fees. Our business customers and nonprofit customers are affected by fees. And, of course, the general fund is affected by our fees. So we need to have a discussion. our proposal among our own staff and with the counties has been that after this legislative session, we do a comprehensive review and come back to the legislature with some suggestion. Obviously, there's a big upfront cost, but then there are lower ongoing costs when you can computerize some of your services. So how do you make the proper balance decision on the fees, and how do you do it in a way that takes into consideration the state's fiscal well-being, large business fiscal well-being, and small business?
Thank you. Is there anyone else here to speak to Senate File 1679? Seeing no one else.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that Senate File 1679 be laid over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 And those opposed?
No. Those opposed. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Does it prevail or not?
The motion prevailed.
Thank you. I'll resume the chair then. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Okay. I had, when we finished the hearing the other day on Senate File 801, we ended just without any opportunity for anybody to testify. Before you arrived, I did ask if there was anybody who was here, because I said that we would take it up if anybody wanted to testify. I did not see anybody coming forward to indicate an interest in it, but I said we would hold off, obviously, if there were, until you got here. But I do not, I'm not aware of anybody who wants to provide any further information on Senate File 801. So Senator Roebling then moves that Senate File 801 be laid over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you. Okay. Senator Roebling, it looks like you're the next author. Senator Saxhog is here? Oh, there he is. Okay. Senator Saxhog will do Senate File 394. He is a co-author of a bill from Senator Senjum, and so he will be presenting on behalf of Senator Senjum. Senator Saxhog, welcome to the Budget Division.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. As you say, we're presenting Senate File 394. It's a bill which chief author was Senator Senjum, who was not able to be here today, and I was a co-author. With me today are Andy Golfus, Citizen Commissioner for the Mississippi River Parkway Commission, and Greg Hubinger, Director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And they're going to give some brief testimony and answer any questions the committee might have.
Okay, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Andrew Golfus, and I have served as the chair of the Minnesota-Mississippi River Parkway Commission. Senator Senjum was our previous chair of the Minnesota-Mississippi River Parkway Commission, and now House Representative Sheldon Johnson is the current chair of the Mississippi River Parkway Commission. You've got a handout in front of you that explains the activities of the Mississippi River Parkway Commission. We are a commission that is now nearing our 70th year of existence of the 10 states up and down the Mississippi River. Our commission has been active in the state in bringing in additional federal dollars for the last 20 years of my involvement. The commission is requesting funds to catch up with activities that coincided with necessary cutbacks in the budget. Our commission was expanded from 10 to 15, but then that following year we were asked to cut our budget and have done so for the last 4 years. The request is to increase for a one-time increase in the budget for us to catch up with our national dues. I sit on the national board as the national chair of the 10 state commissions, and it is hard to convince other states to keep up with their due commitments when our state is still in arrears. So we are asking for the one-time increase to get caught up, and then an increase in the following year to keep us up to speed with the increase in membership of our 10 state commission. We have been successful in the past for bringing in federal dollars that would not come into the state through scenic byways grants. and we continue to do that. And it's with a very small request of continued funding. All of our commission members are volunteers. It's a good bargain for what the state has gotten in return. Thank you. I'll address any questions you may have.
Are there any questions? We do have one, I think, a technical matter that we should take care of on the bill. The way the bill reads, it is that money is appropriated from the general fund to the Mississippi River Parkway Commission. And typically we don't appropriate money to one of these groups that's part of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. So it would be, if there's appropriation, it would be to the Legislative Coordinating Commission for the Mississippi Parkway Commission. So so we would not go straight to this commission. It goes to the LCC. So Kubley moves that. Mr. Bodder, how would we word this?
Mr. Chairman, on page 1, line 7, before Mississippi, insert Legislative Coordinating Commission for the.
Okay. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay. The amendment is adopted. Okay. Is there further discussion? And is there anybody else here who wants to be heard on Senate File 394? There appearing to be none. Senator Kubley moves that Senate File 394, as amended, be laid over for possible consideration into the omnibus budget bill. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Before we established a quorum, we did hear from Senator Sharon, who testified with the Secretary of State on the absentee voting process simplification. And again, the intention is just to lay the bill over for possible consideration of the omnibus bill. So, Senator Roebling, would you make that motion then? You weren't here.
Mr. Chair, I'm not supporting the bill.
You're not supporting the bill. Okay, well, you don't get the motion. Senator Kubley? Okay, would you make that motion that Senate File 208 be laid over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill? Further discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I would call division.
Okay.
We need to vote right now.
There's been a division called on Senator Sharon, putting Senator Sharon's bill, laying it over. All those in favor of laying Senator Sharon's bill for absentee voting simplification over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill. All those in favor of the motion, please raise your hand. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Okay. Senator Roebling, you'll be next. Senate File 326, unclaimed lottery prize money allocation modification.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think there's someone here from the LLCMR, but I'm not sure if
they're. Oh, okay. If the witness.
Right now. Someone here? Well,
do you wish to proceed without them, or how do you want to do this?
We're supposed to be here.
Okay.
But,
well, we can hold off until somebody arrives. If that's your wish, Senator Rest is here. She has a bill. We can go to that one.
Oh, she just left.
She just left. Put her back in. So.
Mr. Chair, I could run through this.
Okay.
It's really quite straightforward, sure. But I can't answer some of the detailed questions on it.
Okay.
But what happened when we had the budget deficit in 2003, we took the unclaimed lottery prize money and put it to the general fund. And this bill is real simple and straightforward. It takes it back and give 60% to the general fund and 40% to the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund. So that is money that the LCCMR.
What does that stand for?
Now gets to spend. And as we all know, the number of requests for funds from that division greatly outnumber the amount of money in the pot. And so we're always looking for additional ways to improve that. We can always improve lottery sales, I suppose. But this is one way, is to take the unclaimed lottery prize money. And there is a fiscal note on it. it would amount to a little over $3 million a year. And so that's what it is. That's how much we got about when we put it all in the general fund when we were looking for funds in 2003 to meet the deficit. And it just is restoring that.
Of course, one of the problems when they made that deal was that the budget targets that we have would be affected by that. Mr. Lundeen, what would be the effect, just to clarify so members know of doing this? Mr. Lundeen.
Yes, if you look at the first page of the fiscal note and you look down on the revenues, there would be a loss of revenue to the general fund of about $3.2 million in fiscal year 8 and $3.2 million in fiscal year 9. So that would be a money, if we did enact this provision, it would count against our target. It would be a cost to the general fund. And then the dollars are instead deposited in the Environmental Trust Fund, so they will see the extra dollars.
Mr. Chair, I realize we have a target that is about $10 million less than we anticipated. And so I...
It's a negative number, right?
when this bill 16, was introduced, yeah. You know, we were hopeful.
Yeah. It does... We have an issue. That's true. And we'll be discussing that next week. But that would dig the hole a little bit deeper for us. But that's fine. We understand that. Who knows? The lightning could strike. I doubt it. Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 326 then? Appears to be none. Any further questions on this bill? So Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 326 be set aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Roebling. And is Senator Resnick back in or not? Did she? I just saw her here. Well, Sarah Pappas, you've got...
918.
You've got 918 and 1158. Which bill did you desire to go first with?
918.
918, the Intellectually and Developmentally Disabled Statewide Self-Advocacy Network Appropriation. Senator Pappas.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. The problem that we're here to address is that persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities have no consistent statewide funding for self-advocacy or a method of formal communication within the state. Minnesota's funding for disability services is only county-based. The majority of counties have no funds to support empowerment and self-determination activities for people with developmental and other disabilities. This proposal is to create a statewide network to assist persons with developmental and other disabilities assert their right to self-determination and to increase individual and collective power to live the lives they want and deserve. And the network is called SAM, Self-Advocates Minnesota. Here to testify on behalf of this proposal is Rick Cardenas and also Gloria Steinbring. And I want to go first.
Okay, yes. Who wants to go first? Well, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Okay,
you need to tell us your name.
Oh, Rick. I'm Rick Cardenas.
Yeah, this
Rick
is
Cardenas,
tape, yeah.
And I'm co-director at Advocating Things Together, Mr. Chair, and members. Again, along with the problem here is that persons with developmental disabilities are generally within the whole process of disabilities around the state seem to fall on the lower rung of those who have access to resources. The resources generally going towards persons with developmental disability are provided through services. And it's service like group home services and social work services. However, very little gets to the person, the consumer with developmental disabilities. This will create a statewide network broken into six regions, I think, as you can see from the map, which will hire at each individual region, will hire a liaison through a host agency and also have the individuals who participate as members of that region. So it will be spreading the concept of self-advocacy throughout the state of Minnesota, within a, on a regional basis. At this time, there is no, as we mentioned earlier, there is no single self-advocacy statewide organization. So okay. what we are proposing is the creation of such a network. We've been having meetings for over a year now on how to lay out the structure, and most of the structure comes directly from the self-advocates themselves. We've been able to start a beginning of this entire project in two regions, in the central region and in the northwest, with a grant from Developmental Disabilities Council. So we're looking for a method to start it throughout the state in the other five regions. Thank you. And Gloria, want to testify?
Okay, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record. Did you testify?
I'm Janet Steinbring. I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm with Advocating Change Together. I'm a founding member of that organization. Thank you for hearing Sam's bill. Self-advocacy is learning about our rights at home, at work, and in our community. And we have put together training kits with self-advocacy with people with disabilities in mind. We helped train them to use the kits that we give them. And I want to make sure persons with mental disability in every part of the state has a chance to gain a strong voice and make more choices in their lives. I am originally from Hibby, Minnesota, the Iron Range, and there is nothing up there. My dream is to see a strong self-advocacy group in my own hometown, and this would help us get that self-advocacy group going. Thank you for having me here today.
Thank you for coming here today. Are there any questions? First to be known, Senator Babbitt.
Mr. Chairman, you can kind of see by the bill what the goals of the network are, and I think they've done quite a bit of work in figuring out the structure of the organization and how they would involve people from the local community and learning more about how they can advocate for themselves in areas like employment, housing, transportation, voting, government policy, and other issues, providing public education and awareness of civil and human rights issues, providing technical assistance and funds and resources for groups across the state, organizing systems of communications. I think they've done a really good job in figuring out exactly what this network would look like. And as Mr. Cardenas said, they've gotten some foundation money to actually start some regional organization.
Are there any questions? Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on SFL 918? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas, would your bill, and I've been noticing the handout here, would your bill satisfy the desire of your witness of putting something up in the Hibbing area for her interest?
Oh.
Or is there something?
Yeah, Chair and Senator Limmer, yes, that would there would be a regional area, probably including Duluth, but the Iron Range also. We actually do have contacts with persons in that area, but there is no structure for them to participate in the overall leadership development training process that they would go through. So.
Further questions? None. Then Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 918 be set aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is there further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you. And then, Senator Pappas, you also have Senate File 1158, the kids voting.
Grab my file. And Mr. Chairman, we do expect we expect a visitor shortly.
Okay. If you want us to hold off, we can
no,
do that.
No, okay. I think he's on his way.
Okay.
The other testifiers. We have he's actually a very famous person. His name is General Election. We hope he'll be arriving shortly. He's just in my office.
Thanks.
Okay. Here, who's going to testify on this?
I think the visitor's coming in right now. So, I see him in the hallway. So.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the whole project of kids voting, which we have chapters in various parts of the state, but in particular there's one in St. Paul that's been around for quite a while and also one in Minneapolis. And the idea is to engage young people really throughout their elementary, junior high, and high school years in debating public policy issues and learning about candidates, and then actually conducting a parallel election at every polling booth. And hopefully the target has been in a lot of lower-income areas where the voting rate is very low, because the hope is that the kids get excited about voting and become lifelong voters, but also in the process they bring their parents with them to the polling booth. And with me I have a couple individuals from the statewide chapter, and one, Mr. Sandstrom from the statewide chapter, who's going to talk about the appropriation and the need to expand it throughout the state, and then we also could hear a little bit about St. Paul if we had some time. And we, like I mentioned, we have our special guest who's coming.
Okay. Who wants to see? Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Lars Sandstrom. I'm Executive Director of Kids Voting Minnesota. We are headquartered in Duluth. The program began in Duluth in 1994, so we've had a program up there for 12 years now. And we have been expanding it through the state, and there is some information in the red folder that you have before you that talks about some of the cities that we're in 2006, and our plans for expansion. It's a significant investment of time and money and people. For example, in 2006, around the state, we had 6,000 volunteers involved. Because of what we do with the kids going to the polls, we have to almost duplicate the whole election process on another level with election judges and ballot tabulators and things like that, in addition to a significant amount of investment and time with teachers in teaching lessons to the kids. We hope to add another 100,000 students to the program this next year, and I've got a listing on the bottom of one of the pages there that kind of lists some of the plans of the potential places to expand this program, and as we go along, it becomes something that we really need to make some substantial investments in Kids Voting Minnesota in terms of staff to grow the program that we would like to.
Anything else? Okay.
Do you want to talk about some of the things you do? We'll let Roger talk.
Sure.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I want to introduce then Roger Barr from Kids Voting St. Paul. Oh.
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Barr. I'm the Executive Director of Kids Voting in St. Paul. And I have a colleague that I'd like to introduce to you at this time, and then I'll make a very quick statement. We have a mascot at Kids Voting St. Paul that literally puts a face on kids voting, and I'd like you to meet him. He is the guy on the fly. He is the bird with the word, and he has the quote on the vote. He is the most regal of eagles, General Election.
We're General. Cue the bird. Okay, here we come. Okay, how you doing?
Why don't you come and join us up here?
General Election goes out into schools and makes public appearances in nonpartisan ways to help spread the word on kids voting. In St. Paul, we have 55,000 students who are in the age group of kindergarten through 12th grade, and in the 2006 midterm elections for kids voting, 16,000 plus public, private, charter and homeschooled students participated in our election. That's one-third, less than one-third of the number of students who could participate. And so with support from this bill, we hope to be able to make inroads towards getting every student in St. Paul, all 55,000, to contribute. I also have materials, if appropriate, that I can leave to be distributed to members of the committee that show how general elections FACE helps to publicize kids voting and how we provide curriculum materials special to St. Paul for teachers, coloring book for students on the electoral process, a newsletter, and other materials. This is a great effort to reach out into our schools and educate students. We do not teach civics in schools the way we used to, partly for budget reasons, partly because we're a standards-driven industry right now in education, and civics are not one of the standards at this time. But the schools are eager to partner with organizations that do provide that instruction, and they do make time in their classrooms. And so support for this bill is critical in helping prepare the next generation of voters. The last thing that Kids Voting St. Paul does is each year we distribute voter registration cards to seniors throughout the St. Paul Public School System and help them register so that they can transform this experience into actual adult responsibilities.
So, Mr. Chairman and members, what St. Paul has done, and I think Roger can pass on more materials for you, is they've actually gone beyond simply getting kids to vote on Election Day, because that's only part of it. It's a whole process of civic education where they need to understand about the political process. They need to understand about what leadership is and what elected office is and what their responsibility is as a member of a democracy. So they have, and it's age appropriate, so they have coloring books for the young kids, and they have teacher's guides, and then they also engage the kids, I think as he mentioned, in volunteers as well, and helping to get other kids to the polls. And I think you have a network of adults, though, that actually run the election.
We have adults that run the election, Mr. Chair. 400 volunteers participate in the kids voting election to get the materials into the polling places, to serve as election judges, and to get the materials back and counted. The results of the kids voting election are submitted to the media for publication the same time that the official election results. So all in all, it is as parallel an experience to the official election as it can possibly be for students, and the students love it.
Mr. Chairman, we can respond to questions, or Mr. Sandstrom can tell you what other cities have taken up this project. We just think that with the appropriation, we'd be able to spread the idea of kids voting a lot more quickly.
Senator Roebling.
And sustain it.
Senator Roebling has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two of my school districts, Prairie Lake and Shakopee, both participate and get a lot of kids energized and out to the polls, and it actually has worked out quite well. There were a few problems at a few sites where the voter turnout for the adults was, well, it was so heavy that it became a little bit of a congestion problem. But they tried to move the kids voting to a little bit of a different part of the school building or wherever the polling place was, so that they would have room to accommodate everybody who was coming in the doors. And I know our voter turnout is very high. The one thing that I've always been a little puzzled about, though, is I know the kids run their own campaigns within the schools, and they have campaign managers for different candidates, but very seldom do they contact the actual candidates for information. So I don't know if they just pull information off of websites or try and pick up campaign literature. I mean, it's not common at all to be invited in to talk to kids, and I've often wondered why don't they actually engage the candidates in the schools too.
Senator, in the 2005 mayoral election in St. Paul, we organized a forum in which the students asked the questions to the mayoral candidates. We also created a video by featuring all the former mayors of St. Paul, with the exception of Senator Coleman, who was in Washington and unable to participate. There were four former mayors in St. Paul who spoke about the role of the mayor in this city and provided excellent education for the students about the role of the mayor in the city. And as a footnote, one of the mayors, former Mayor Latimer, told me that it was the first time that all the former mayors had stood in the same room together ever. So it was quite a coup for kids voting to be able to do that.
I would also say that this past election cycle, we had a Secretary of State candidate debate in Crookston, Minnesota, and all the candidates participated in that. It's something we had done 4 years ago in Thief River Falls. But directly in answer to your question, Senator Roebling, a lot of that is up to the teachers to determine that. We try and encourage them and continue to do that, to encourage them to get the candidates to actually come in and talk to the classes. Obviously, they have to keep it balanced and get both sides there and do that. But it's a very important part of the program that we would like to expand. I think the one other thing I would like to say is we started this in Duluth in 1994, and we have elections every year in Duluth. So this year was our 12th year. We had students who started kids voting in kindergarten, and many of them were 18 and were able to vote for real this year. I visited classes at Central High School in Duluth. I asked the students about it. 90% of the students said that they had voted 8 or more times since kindergarten. And
hopefully not at the same time.
not at the same time.
Right. Okay.
But they were obviously well prepared to be voters. And that, I think, is a good testimony to it, plus the fact that Duluth, Minnesota, as a city, had the highest voter turnout in the entire country. In the last presidential election, we had over a 90% voter turnout in Duluth. We can't take credit for all of it, but kids voting's been there for 12 years. I think we helped contribute to that.
Mr. Chairman, general election doesn't speak, but we do have a student here. We'd just like to make a brief statement to the committee about his experience with kids voting.
Thank you. And can we remind the witnesses we need to have you sign in on the sheet that's there so we can keep track of the correct spelling of the name of the witnesses. Please identify yourself for the record, and welcome to the Budget Division.
Good morning. I'm Charlie Platt. I've voted every year at a church in St. Paul, and last year I voted, and I volunteered to become an election judge, and I thought it was great that so many people came in to vote. And with my social studies class at school, it's required that you vote online at the school, and yeah.
So they have, is this through kids voting as well, the online option?
Yes, there's an online option that you can also do on the computer.
Yeah. St. Paul does offer that. Minneapolis, with their kids voting, decided, Senator Rest would like this, that it was more important for the kids to actually go to the polls than to do the online option. But sometimes in an election like with the school board, the city council coming up, you know, it may work just as well for them to vote online. Something else I wanted to say.
Okay.
I forgot.
Any questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. And anybody else? If you got anything further, Senator Pappas? Anything further?
No, I guess not. Okay. I had another thought, but I forgot. So, sorry.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Yep. Chairman. Then I would move that Senate File 1158 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Pappas. Senator Roebling, could you chair while I present a couple of bills here?
That's a lot. General election saying goodbye. He doesn't speak.
See you out there.
They were here and they had deaf blind. So you gain information when you're both deaf.
Senator Betzold, are you doing Senate File 130 first?
Why don't we do that? That's a fairly simple bill. Senate File 130 is an appropriation for the Legislative Coordinating Commission to oversee legislative training forums. In the past couple of years, we've usually tried to have some forums at the start of a legislative session for bringing outside guest speakers. It's something that is done with the agreement of all four of the caucus leaders in both the House and the Senate. Basically, it's for bringing guest speakers for information that we may not receive elsewhere. As you can see just from the description of the bill, this would include demographic issues, economic perspectives on Minnesota, its role in the global economy, and so forth. we've often tried to do these things at the start of a legislative session before things really start kicking into gear. And this is an appropriation of $20,000 from the general fund to the Legislative Coordinating Commission. This is only for fiscal year 2008. That is, this will be an appropriation for next year's legislative session. I do have Mr. Hubinger here from the Legislative Coordinating Commission. I believe that most members are familiar with some of the forms we've had passed. This is, as I say, just providing some funds to the LCC so that if it's the desire of the legislature to have similar forms again next year, that can be.
Members have any questions? Senator Betzold, I think this is a very worthwhile endeavor. I really appreciated the program that we had this year and some of the other ones we've had in past years, and there obviously has to be some appropriation for that. Senator Pappas?
I agree that I think the legislative training has been very helpful. One thing I would like to see, though, made strengthened is the ability of outside groups to sponsor legislative forums. I think they need to be more closely coordinated with the LCC, with legislative leadership in terms of their timing. And I'll just give you an example. There was a bioscience forum that the legislature was invited to. And with this one in particular, I don't recall if we got email notices from the leadership or not. I decided it was during my committee time, so I decided to take my committee there. And when I just thought it was for the general public, but it seemed like something that my committee would be interested in. And when I got there, I found out that no, it wasn't for the general public. It was just for the legislature. And there were a half a dozen, eight legislators there, and it was embarrassing. You had top scientists from the University of Minnesota, top business leaders that were there. You know, Vance Opperman was one of the moderators. You know, he had media people that were there. It was a big deal, and it was at the History Center. And it was during a time when we were too busy. We were, you know, it was a Thursday afternoon or something, and everybody was running every which way. In fact, we all had to leave early because we had to leave at 2:30, 2:45 when our committee time was up. Most of my committee members had to leave. I stayed a little bit longer. But we just really can't let that happen, where if we're going to have a day for legislative training, then it needs to be something where there are no committees that are called. Let me give you another example. When the Indian Affairs Council had 2 days of informational meetings for the legislature, at the same time, we were all busy. I had set aside time to go to one of them, and I ended up having to cancel because, you know, a budget chairs meeting came up or we had something else that was scheduled, we had a floor session, whatever. And that was one in which the leadership encouraged us to go, and it was right here at the Capitol. So I just think they need to happen in January, you know, before we get too busy during session, and we need to be selective. It needs to be coordinated with the leadership. The LCC could play a really important role here, I think, in providing the coordination and not set us up, basically, for failure because we fail to show up for an event we're supposed to be at because we have to be in three places at once. And I'm sorry, I'm ranting on and on. I'll stop now.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now it's my turn to rant, but
I
think when we have some of these, I do have to admit that sometimes some of the subject matter occasionally, especially on controversial issues, sometimes has a single perspective. And I think it's wise as public policy makers to, when we have these opportunities to have experts from around the country come, to have more than one view, that it should be, it doesn't have to be a confrontational point-counterpoint, but it should be an intellectual discussion of a variety of issues and views and perspectives so that we as public policy makers can appreciate the whole discussion and the development of the issue. Going to a one-sided event in the name of a program invited for legislators does not interest me. I want to hear a variety of perspectives on it. And when it is, even if it's a perspective that I may be in favor of, I don't need to go. because I won't be learning anything new. And so in the future, I know that they've attempted to do that, but there are times when it's fairly single-focused, and I don't know if that necessarily promotes the what you're trying to accomplish. And so in the future, I'd hope that we could have a little bit more wider global perspectives being shared at these events. There's certainly experts on every issue out there, and I think we can invite them.
Well, Madam Chair, I think Mr. Hubinger can discuss how the process that they go through to identify the forums and the speakers and so forth.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. One of the other folks on our staff was responsible for coordinating the planning for the conference that that occurred in January. And Senator Limmer raises a very interesting and it's the challenge to organize a conference and present interesting viewpoints and find a way to present it in such a way that it's of interest to the members and provides the policy background that members need to be able to do their work here. The individual speakers were found through a process that was led by staff directors from each of the four caucuses. As I understand it, those four folks signed off on each of the speakers, and I believe that they were also presented to the leadership.
And that was the one at the Humphrey Institute.
That was the one at the Humphrey Institute.
Yes, right. Yes.
And that was an excellent forum, I thought. I attended the whole day and was very, very well informed when I came away from there. Any other comments? Senator Olstein?
Is it the Legislative Coordinating Commission that put on our three-day training for the freshmen?
Madam Chair and Senator Olstein, the LCC coordinated that three-day event. It was a heavy staff involvement by House leadership, Senate leadership to organize the agenda and to put together the speakers and organize the staff that did the presentations.
Senator Olstein?
I have to say that was fabulous training, and for an especially big freshman class, I think it was very well presented, and it was very timely and very useful. So that was a good experience, I think, for all of us.
Senator Olstein, you were one of the first lucky senators to have a three-day training. Most of us in the Senate had much shorter orientation programs. A couple hours.
So, thank you.
Any other questions?
Sink or swim. You know, just throw us in the water and see what happens. So, as I say, I don't believe that there's anybody else here who has on this one. And, of course, for the 2008 session, we don't know the starting date of that session. That'll have to be determined later on. And because it's a short year, things are going to go fast, but I think Senator Pappas's point is quite well taken that if they're going to schedule these things, I think the leaders in both bodies have to kind of cover up the time so we can go to them. It doesn't help us to schedule them and then say, well, if you can get there, get there. Well, okay, I'll move that Senate File 130 be set aside for possible inclusion into the omnibus budget bill.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The bill is considered for inclusion.
Chair, perhaps the state auditor is here. Maybe we can move to their appropriation bill, Senate File 1560.
1382,
right. Yeah. Okay. We've got some handouts here, too. So. And I believe we may have seen these are the ones we saw earlier. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, Senator Betzel, do you want to?
It's a special request from the state auditor. The legislature last year in the tax bill directed that the auditor do audits of the JobZ program. And so, since that has been directed, this was not covered in the governor's budget recommendations. But as I say, since the legislature directed it be done, I introduced a bill on behalf of the state auditor to deal with that issue, and the state auditor is here to further discussion.
Okay. I'm Rebecca
Auditor Otto.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Rebecca Otto, state auditor, and I guess we're covering the JobZ.
Yes.
And we were, in 2005, we were given the duty of auditing JobZ, the JobZ program, and we realized that funds are very limited at this time, and so we were trying to put together a very streamlined conservative program to begin the oversight process of JobZ. And currently, there isn't a whole lot there. So we want to make sure that there's accountability and transparency in the program, and so that we can provide you with data that helps you to evaluate the program as you go forward. And so the JobZ, the first year we have, first year is $210,000, and in 08 and 09 is $160,000. You have 100, yep. So it's a total of $370,000 for the biennium, which is a 2.2% increase.
As I indicated, Madam Chair, this is something the legislature directed to be done, and so I guess we're going to have to look within our budget as well as discuss with the tax committee as to what they want to have proceed here, because obviously we can't direct something to be done unless we put some money to fund it. So one way or the other, we have to either have the tax committee revisit, do they want this done, or we have to provide some funding for it, and this is the issue that is before us at this time.
Do members have any questions? You know, I was just wondering, I'm on the topic selection for the Legislative Audit Commission, and last year this program was one of the programs that was recommended for evaluation. It was not selected because it had not been in existence long enough, and they thought that a program should be around for 2 or 3 years before they evaluated it. And it may be coming up, may have been recommended again for an evaluation. We'll be meeting soon to see which programs are recommended. I don't know if that would be significantly different than your audit or not. I just want to make sure that we won't be overlapping, or maybe we shouldn't even consider it if you're going to do it. And so I'm just wondering about reaction to that.
Madam Chair and members, that's a great question. If we get the funding, then we should do it, and there would be overlap. If we don't get the funding, then you'll want somebody providing oversight in it. And to be frank with you, I believe there's some issues just with the way the program is set up right now and the data that's available and hard numbers versus soft numbers. So it's going to be complicated to do anyway, and we'd like to work to tighten it up and make sure we have a good functioning program. So, again, if we don't get the funding, it would be difficult for us to do, and then you're going to want somebody to do it. So we're happy to do it, and it is local government, and it is within our, you know, it's something that we do. We work with local government already. But obviously we need our office, too, and you're looking at the funding for that, and we can't afford to lose another person there. So it'll be really up to you all as to how you structure that. So,
okay, thank you. Any other questions?
I don't know that there's anybody else here. As I say, I introduce this at the request of the state auditor. So if there are any further questions, Madam Chair, then I'll move that the Senate file 1679 be laid aside in consideration in the
All in favor?
1382.
It is 1382.
Sorry, I got the wrong file. 1382. I
looked wrong. Okay. All in favor of Senator Betzel's motion on Senate file 1382, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The bill will be laid over for consideration.
I also have
to eliminate this. Yep.
Is somebody can return?
This is a stupid problem.
The Attorney General's office did have a request that they mentioned as part of their presentation. They were talking about additional 13 positions, and again, that was not part of the government recommendation, but since they are a separate constitutional office, I requested that a bill be introduced on their introduced a bill on their behalf so they can discuss it. I believe that they did review this as part of their overview when we were going through there. They're part of the budget, but I do have the bill before us as I requested be done, and so this is their request, and they can refresh the budget division memory on the details of what they are seeking here.
Madam Chair, my name is Rebecca Spartz. I'm the Director of Administration for the Attorney General's Office. The Attorney General is testifying on a bill in the House, which is why she's not here. Briefly, I'll go over our request. It is for 13 attorney positions and one legal assistant or investigator position. And in our previous meeting, we did discuss the fact that the Attorney General has received a number of budget cuts since 1999. In 1999, we had 548 people on staff. We currently have 367. It's one-third fewer attorneys than we had in 1999. Because the Attorney General provides a service, we're 80% salary. So when we get budget cuts, that means that we have to cut people. When the Attorney General-elect was attempting to set priorities for submitting the budget in December of 2006, she was looking at our total caseload, which at any given time is about 2,000 cases. And she looked at areas of great growth or where there is a real need. And this is where she came up with the request for the different areas. The first area is civil commitment. And civil commitment is something that we had thought there might be a peak and then it would decrease, but it has not. In the year 2000, we had 6 cases. In the year 2006, we had 35, and we do not see a decrease coming. We assist Greater Minnesota counties with the civil commitment process, and it is an intensive process which requires you have to go back to the original victims and so forth. You have to sort of build a case again to get somebody civilly committed. Now, that person has served the criminal part of their sentence, but they're now ready to either be released into the community or to be committed civilly to St. Peter or to Moose Lake. Drug cases. We have found that in the state of Minnesota, the manufacture of meth has gone down, but the importing of it from Mexico has actually increased. So consequently, we continue to assist the counties with drug prosecutions. In the past, the office received a grant, which is called the Byrne Grant, from the federal government to prosecute cases of this sort. The grant has been steadily reduced, and it will end at the end of this year, which is why we're asking for money to cover drug prosecution. More and more, the Attorney General is being contacted by veterans who are serving their country, typically in Iraq, and who are having issues, legal issues. And they contact this office to do something about those issues. And there are a number of organizations that do help veterans. We do not want additional staff to take over those duties. We want to work with those agencies so that these veterans get a quick answer and get a correct answer. And quite often, we have found that the fact that it is the Attorney General's office talking to a company or whatever, that they're much more, we can assume, and we have found that they are much more willing to work with us in that case than when they're working directly with the family of the veteran or the veteran himself or herself. In the appeals area, we continue to see an increase in appeals. One of the reasons for that is that the United States Supreme Court decided a decision called Blakely. And what that decision said is that if a judge differs from the sentencing guidelines when he's going to sentence the person who's been convicted, that you have to have another trial to do that. The judge can't just decide to move outside of the sentencing guidelines. So that has caused a large number of appeals to come forward because these cases were still pending that they could have an appeal while Blakely was being decided. The other area that she is very concerned about and has introduced legislation and is testifying about now in the House is predatory lending. We became involved in this because of consumers coming to us. And in investigating it, we discovered that it is a huge problem in the state of Minnesota, that it's not only a concern or concern of hers because of individuals who are losing everything because they're being foreclosed on, but it does become an economic problem for the whole state. And it is something that we need to deal with. The AGO took the lead in a multi-state case against Ameriquest for predatory lending, and that did result in a $325 million settlement from Ameriquest. In the antitrust area, mergers, friendly takeovers, acquisitions continue to rise. This is a very complicated area of the law, and so when you work on a case, it takes an extensive amount of time. We work on cases on our own, but we also work on them with the Department of Justice when the Department of Justice is going after a company. And then finally, in the pharmaceutical industry, this is an area where there are a lot of lawsuits. And one of the reasons that you see them is because of allegations of fraud. How much is being charged for prescriptions? whether or not the medication does what it's supposed to do, if there are side effects that were never identified to that medication. And so the Attorney General frequently goes into lawsuit mode against a particular drug company, and we do make recoveries for the state in terms of the Medicaid program that the state has. And so for those reasons, she is asking for these additional positions, and if you have questions, I hope I can answer them.
Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, when the Attorney General was here, she I think she was telling us that some of the settlements actually do go into the general fund.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, yes, they do go into the general fund. However, if DHS was running a program, the Medicaid program, and we got a drug settlement, then some of that money would go directly back to that program. But, yes, in general, settlements do go into the general fund.
Senator Olsen?
A follow-up might be, would you say that there, from this additional 13 attorneys and investigator, we might be able to offset those costs, or are they mainly...
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, I would say that particularly the predatory lending, the pharmaceutical antitrust, yes, we probably would, because we do recover a great deal more than we actually have in our budget for salaries.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Spartz? Senator Betzel?
And Madam Chair, again, I wanted to lay forward the Attorney General's request. So I will move that Senate File 1568 be laid over for possible consideration.
All in favor of Senator Betzel's motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The bill 1568 will be laid over for consideration.
And Madam Chair, I have the introduced to bill Senate File 1361. To restore the full funding for the Land Management Information Center. And this, as you may recall, there was some one-time money that was sort of set aside. We had some extensive discussion on this, and I believe there are some people who are here on it. This basically restores the funding back to the base that was cut. And I believe if anybody, we have people who are here want to be testified.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Morey, and I'm here in my capacity as chair of the Legislative Committee of the Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors to support restoring funding to the Land Management Information Center. The LMIC provides the opportunity to partner among various agencies as well as the private sector, and also as a clearinghouse to provide a wealth of information regarding the land. Just two projects that I want to point out that I'm familiar with are the statewide parcel map inventory, which is an annual review and detailing of what sort of information is available on a county-by-county basis in terms of parcel boundaries, parcel ownership, that sort of thing, and how it's available, who to contact. This project, like I say, LMIC hosts this. They provide oversee the annual updating of it. This project in 2004 received the Research Partnership Award from the Center of Transportation Studies of the University of Minnesota. Another project that I'm familiar with that LMIC's involvement is they host the, make available over the web, the Government Land Office Original Public Land Survey Plats, which are the basis of all property ownership in the state of Minnesota. This was another joint project that received this last year in 2006 a governor's commendation at the recommendation of the Governor's Council on Geographic Information. So these are just two examples of the role LMIC plays in partnering with and promoting and making available land information. Through these efforts, LMIC provides the opportunity to leverage tax dollars, allowing a multitude of players, each with a small amount of money, to combine their budgets and projects for a synergistic effect, which produces a result far greater than any of them could otherwise achieve if they could do anything at all. Additionally, as a clearinghouse, LMIC serves as a sole point of contact for land information, which allows not only professionals who need this information, but also the average citizen the opportunity to find what they're looking for without getting lost in the bureaucratic maze that characterizes so much of the search for information in government. This, in turn, leaves the citizens feeling that they are getting a good return on their investment in this area. So for these reasons, the Society supports restoring the funding to the Land Management Information Center. Thank you.
Mr. Morey, do you charge any organizations fees for your services?
My services?
Oh, for LIMIC. Does LIMIC charge any fees?
To access the information?
To access information for, especially if they're private organizations or businesses that might need the information.
Right, Madam Chair, I can't speak for how LIMIC runs their operation. I believe Rabbi is here to address that. He can address that issue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Arbeit. I direct the Office of Geographic and Demographic Analysis and the Land Management Information Center. All of the information that is provided through LIMIC is public information, is available at no cost to all the folks who use it, including the private sector, which gives our businesses a competitive advantage in doing their work in Minnesota.
Senator Alcine?
Madam Chair, thank you very much. In one of the counties I represent, they're doing some GIS mapping and all those kinds of things, and they have access to, anybody can get it, but there's a fee per service. I'm just wondering, Madam Chair brought up the question, if this couldn't go towards a fee per service basis and maybe become more self-supporting.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, actually, maybe my earlier statement wasn't clear enough. As I presented last week, much of our operation is funded through fees. But in terms of the coordination and data clearinghouse functions, that is not. When I came to the state 13 years ago, we did charge on cost recovery basis for our data. And as I presented in committee last week, there were really, on an annual basis, we never had more than 35 requests. The fee was actually a barrier to local units of government and other organizations using the data. Last year, we had 40,000 requests for data that were provided and are in pretty widespread use.
Senator Olsen?
Following up on that, those 40,000, are those like realtors, developers, who's accessing that data?
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, they're mostly local units of government, as well as there's quite a bit that's being used for research and educational purposes.
Any other questions, Mr. Senator Olsen?
I'm sorry, but this 13 years ago, I don't know if GIS was as popular or as available it is now. I know if counties are looking at doing these flyovers and this GIS mapping, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. So if you guys are already doing these services or have these services available, I would think it might be, worthwhile to look into going back to some kind of fee schedule.
Yeah. Actually, Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, none of our appropriation is used to develop data. We don't have adequate funding to do that. What we do is coordinate among state agencies and local units of government to assemble investments that they're willing to make that aren't quite enough to do the whole job. So we aggregate that demand, and part of our coordination function is to put those pieces together so that we can leverage those investments. In 2003, we assembled $250,000 from state agencies that were leveraged with about $600,000 in federal funds that otherwise wouldn't have been made available to Minnesota to do flights for the entire state. And when you go to your local county and look at what their GIS operations are using, if you're seeing photographs as part of their GIS maps that they're producing, they are coming from that investment.
So, Mr. Chair, I know that my count, or Mr. Chair, sorry, Mr. Arbeit. I know Scott County now has a GIS department or office.
That's right.
and they, I can go to their website and pull up all kinds of things for Scott County.
That's right.
So you're saying that you help coordinate that so we can get a picture for the whole state as these local units of government put these projects together?
Madam Chair, members, yes, that is among the things that we do, is an attempt to pull together the local efforts so that it makes some coherent sense for the state as a whole. In the case of Scott County, if there are problems or issues that require GIS to be used beyond the boundaries of the county, emergency response or natural resource kind of issue or anything like that, there's a need to be able to seamlessly integrate the data from Scott County with its neighbors so that that can be brought to the issue quickly and at low cost.
You know, they also have, and I don't know, maybe they get this information through sources like you, but there's some website called Project Earth or Satellite Earth, and you could pull up things from all over the state right now by going on there and look at your backyard or look at your neighbor's backyard. You can focus right in on all kinds of things. Are they collecting through you, or do they have their own gathering source of information?
Madam Chair, that the Google Earth, which is probably what you're referring to, is one of actually several services that are now available that use publicly available data and assemble them and package them for consumer use. And it's really doing a lot to raise awareness of how the data can be used effectively. All of the data you see there is data that come from the public domain, and if when you're especially looking in areas of Minnesota outside of the metro, you were in all likelihood looking at data that comes from our clearinghouse site.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, Senator Youngbauer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I came in late on the discussion. Two committees at once, so maybe you already said something about this, but I'm trying to get kind of an overview of how this all works together. I work with quite a number of surveyors in my business that buy specialty satellite photography and stuff. That seems like it would almost be duplicative of what the counties are doing. Is there coordination between these private entities and what we can do in terms of government?
Is that Dave? Madam Chair, Senator, as the representative of the Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors, MSPS has contributed dollars out of its funding to several of the projects that LIMIC has available over the web. So as a professional organization, we do financially support some of these projects and the work LIMIC does in regards to them.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Bessel, do you have other witnesses?
The other people do wish to testify.
Madam Chair, my name is Will Craig. I'm at the University of Minnesota. I'm also the vice chair of the Governor's Council on Geographic Information and a board member of NISGIC, the National States Geographic Information Council. I say the latter because you all have gotten, and I think got circulated recently just sort of as a reminder, a letter from NISGIC talking about the importance of states being able to coordinate their own activities, and then collectively we meet as an organization and try to leverage what the federal government's doing that affects states and get the best bang for the buck out of that. And as long as LIMIC and State of Minnesota have been a part of that, it's really been an important partnership. Let me turn back to the hat I wear as vice chair of the Governor's Council of Geographic Information. That group consists of many representatives of state and local government, and for just a second I'd like to focus on the state government members who are from Department of Natural Resources, Department of Agriculture, Pollution Control Agency, Bowser, and the Department of Public Safety Division of Homeland Security, and also I should say the Office of Enterprise Technology. Every one of those executive offices is incredibly dependent upon and supportive of LIMIC, but they can't come here and say that to you because this is an executive proposal that's come to you, the proposal from the governor, and yet they would love to say, we can't do our job unless we work together, and the only way we can work together is through the governor's council and through LIMIC. So To reduce that kind of coordinating activity at the same time we're trying to be more efficient in government just doesn't make any sense.
Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Craig?
Chair.
Senator Loomer?
I don't know if this is for Mr. Craig. I'm reading this handout, National State Geographic Information Council. And in the second paragraph, there's a reference to a potential role in the effective operation of state fusion centers. I don't know if you talked about state fusion centers when I was out of the room, but what is that?
Fusion centers is a federal Department of Homeland Security's attempt to get various law enforcement offices working together. And this is an issue that in many states is sort of ignoring what states are doing with any of their information technology, but including GIS. And what is happening at the national level is to try to get Homeland Security and the NISGIC, that is the state information technology people, working together more closely. And this is one of the things that we're doing in Minnesota with our Division of Homeland Security and Department of Public Safety. The idea is to get the FBI and the local cops and the police and the county sheriff's office sort of all pretty much in the same rooms sharing the same information. And obviously information is both what's in people's heads and what's in the computer, and this is part of what that solution is about and what this letter is referencing.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
It might be wise to, in order to promote or understand some of these technologies and fusion centers, that maybe some of our policy committees, I serve on criminal justice and judiciary, and I would think that something that's putting together law enforcement agencies and under this name, I've never heard of this before. And so it might be wise to avail yourself of these committee chairs and perhaps during a non-busy time of the year bring us up to date with some of these things, because it certainly will have impact when you're making reference to the use in law enforcement and intelligence applications, and that the warning is that these applications will grow at exponential rates. And, of course, there are other concerns when things like this happen. There's data privacy issues. There's civil rights concerns of some people. There's the cost of state dollars and how they intersect with federal money. And so it would be nice for the policy side to understand this a little bit more, because this is the first reference I've seen in any public document regarding this.
Senator Limmer and Madam Chair, that's a very good point, and it's interesting how hard it was for even this national group to get Homeland Security to tell us about fusion centers. And mm-hmm. so I think the issue is, in many ways, tied up in the same confidentiality and sensitivity issues that that you referenced, and sort of getting governments to share information with each other is tough, and it's a constant battle to be connecting with the feds, and one of the only ways we're able to do that is through the services of LIMIC working with our Division of Homeland Security, and that some of those doors begin to get open. Now, sharing that with the legislature is obviously the next step, and I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Claypool?
Yes, I'm David Claypool. I'm the Ramsey County Surveyor, Madam Chair, and members, and I'm not here representing Ramsey County today, but the County Surveyors Association. And I want to speak to the GIS side of it as well. Big Ramsey County has had the first coordinate control GIS in the state for several years. We started in 1985, and we had it ready about 1991. And when those original steps were taken to create that database and to create what we wanted to have for a GIS, in those days, LIMIC was fee-based. And it was not possible to get it done under those circumstances at that point in time because of that. So we did our own. And the reason we did our own is because, as fee-based, they couldn't provide all the services at the time because of their circumstances. And so we did it the way we wanted to do it. And for several years, we've worked actively to try to work for a statewide program. The state of Minnesota is blessed with strong county governments that provide a lot of good local data. That data and the information that's located in the local county governments resides there unless we have a place like Limick to run it together with the rest of the counties. One of the major problems that happens is that if there's a federal initiative without having Limick involved in this, we simply wouldn't have any target place for the federal programs to come to in the state. There's no other department at the state that handles the data, the GIS functions and the other functions the same as Limick is able to do. And besides that, they have the people to work that have the experience and the wisdom that, to work with it. Now, why is that important to counties? Well, the reason, one of the reasons it's important to counties is because let's just take one issue, Initiative National Imagery. They want to figure out some way so that the federal can come up with a contract. And by the way, we're working on that within the state with all of the people that Mr. Craig has just mentioned. We're working to eliminate these double flights and overflights, and we're working hard to do that so that we can keep the cost down. But National Imagery is going to be a, let's just call it a federal a project and a contract that we can all buy into at the county level and at the city level, which would save billions over time if people would to buy into it. Now, what's the difference between the data you can already get from those web pages that you mentioned? You can get some pretty good-looking stuff out there. You really can. I can go to my hometown in England and see it just fine. But the fact of the matter is I don't know too much about that. It's just a picture. In the world of mapping, the world of GIS, and the world for sure of surveying, we need to know what the value of the data is. And we call that metadata, that awful word we hear from time to time. The stuff that goes into David Arbide's system cannot go in there without an explanation of the accuracy, the value of the data of the data, just all the internal stuff you need to know whether that's even any good or not. Then we can turn around and others can use it fully for the purposes they need to if they see that it's of value to them personally. But we are, in Minnesota, we are recognized as one of the most advanced states in geospatial type things, GIS and all the rest. And yet at the top, at the very top of this, what David Arbide is trying to do with his unit is we don't show up very good because other states control the whole thing through their assessors or something. Their data's not very good. It comes from the top down. And we're fortunate we have all the good data from the bottom up. And that's why this particular unit is so important.
Mr. Claypool, do even the smaller counties, are they able to provide data on a regular basis to keep it updated?
Madam Chair and members, some counties don't do that yet. They don't have that kind of activity. But again, through the Governor's Council and outreach programs and other things that we're doing, we're inviting them to come in. We're looking at some of those smaller counties having a consortium of counties, three or four or five getting together to invest in some of these things. And mostly it's just because there's not enough activity in those areas. But with the bill that was passed, and I believe went into effect in August last year, where there's additional funding through the recorder's documents, some of the counties now have that opportunity to utilize some of that money to create some of these databases and some of the things they need for GIS.
Any other questions? I have one other question about satellite images that... And usually those would be the federal government, I imagine. Is there coordination with them to receive some of those satellite images? Because they probably have the furthest corners of our state even covered.
Madam Chair and members, yes, they do, but there's many different kinds of satellite imagery. Some of it's only down to a meter in accuracy. Again, we're talking what's the value of it in reality other than just to look at it. Can I use it to assess property? Can I use it to measure property? Can I use it to describe property? Things like that. And you really can't do that with a satellite. But, yes, you can see all these different places. Right at the moment, I'm not sure just how – there's no direct connection to the state on who takes the physical. And I'll turn this over to Will on that, Madam Chair.
Sorry if I can. The standard and cheapest – satellite data, of course, it's available every day, but the one grain of the piece of film is about 30 meters on a side or a football stadium, a baseball stadium. So you can't tell very much about what's really going on. I've overstated that. It's you can see maybe nine in the Saints stadium. So you don't have very much detail. By the time you get down to the 1 meter David just mentioned, yeah, you can get it that way, but it's about $17,000 a picture, and a picture wouldn't cover a single suburb. So it's much more expensive, and then, as David says, you've still just got just some gray, some light, some dark. It's a picture, and somebody has to do some interpretation. There is a federal program that turns some of that into a land use measure, and that's available, again, through LIMIC and the USGS. But that's the one case where the data is processed, and then it's free. But before that, you're talking tens of thousands of dollars to cover a single city.
Okay, any other questions? Senator Betzel, do you have a motion?
Yeah, I don't know if there's anybody else here who wants to be heard on this, and if there is not, then I would move that Senate File 1361 be set aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus budget bill.
Any further discussion, or is there anyone else out in the audience who wants to testify? Otherwise, all in favor of Senator Betzel's motion on 1361, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion is being laid over for consideration in the omnibus bill.
Madam Chair, I guess the only other bill we have left is Senator Rest with 1375.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1375 addresses an issue that was brought up when the CAP Board made their budget presentation when we were dealing with overviews. And the chairman suggested that in one of the areas in which there was deficiency, that we could consider making up that deficiency by introducing a bill. And so I did that. I don't know if you have the this handout that they had prepared with their budget presentation, but it very clearly indicates on the if you save that on the second page, the governor had only recommended looks like $77 million.
We do have our budget.
I'm sorry, 77,000.
We have our budget books available.
Yes,
so
and
you can look it up
it's
there,
in
so.
Your budget. But one of the things that the CAP Board, and even with that, that does not restore the agency to being a full-time agency, and they right now operate at 80%.
80%.
And so they only work to do that. They work at 4 days a week and adjust their hours accordingly. The request had been for $220,000, but then also the thing that was noted in the committee was the requirement coming up for the decennial, the every 10 years comprehensive plan that the CAP Board as well as other local governments needs to do with regard to a requirement from the Met Council's comprehensive planning law. And so what this bill does, and the governor did not include any money, acknowledgement of that obligation of the CAP Board in his budget. So this proposal suggests a one-time funding of $65,000, which is the cost to update the comprehensive plan and zoning and design rules for the capital area pursuant to the requirement that is imposed on them by the their statutory responsibility as well as the Metropolitan Council statute for comprehensive plan. And it seemed to me in particular that the governor's increase really ended up being no increase at all because they have to meet that that statute, not really any increase at all, because they have to meet that statutory requirement. So that is the sum and substance of the bill, and we have Mr. Mandrell, Ms. Stark here to comment further on perhaps what goes into preparing that comprehensive plan.
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Nancy Stark. I am the Executive Secretary of the CAP Board. Senator Rest is right in saying that there is extensive work in what this will be for our little agency. One of the things that we need to do is certainly identify any deficiencies that we have within our comp plan and changes then that would be impacting our zoning and design rules. And we must review these not only with our architectural advisors, but also to hire consultants to assist us in this overview of the comp plan. I might also add that it was nearly 10 years ago that these documents were developed extensively, and so at the course of the end of this biennium, the 10-year period would be up for us, and that's why we're coming forward at this particular time. We also need to write all of the sonar relative to the changes that we make with these documents, and of course then there's printing for public notice procedures, and this means printing in the state registry, and the expense of printing a single page has nearly doubled since we did this 8.5 years ago. And then, of course, there's final review by not only the advisors, staff, but obviously the board and adoption by the board. So we see this as a timely event for us. It's going to take time, and we would like to start it at the beginning of this biennium, so we will have met state law at the end of 10 years, which will be in 2009. I don't know whether Paul has anything he'd like to add.
To discuss?
No, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I'll just open ourselves up to questions if
okay.
You have any.
Are there any questions? Anybody else who wants to be heard on this issue?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say that this is a statutory responsibility for the board to revise their comprehensive planning, and they do have this zoning responsibility for the neighborhood in the area of the Capitol, so I think it's really important that we help them with the expenses to get the job done.
So if we're going to require it, we should help them pay for it.
Yeah. And this is a one-time request. This is not adding to their base.
Gotcha. Any further discussion? Mr. Junkbauer.
I guess I'm, kind of new to this end of the statement of need and reasonableness. That's usually associated with, rule changes and stuff. How does that happen with what you're doing?
Mr. Chair, Paul Mandel, a principal planner for the CAP Board and zoning administrator. Because we're a state agency, we are subject to APA Administrative Procedures Act, and so instead of going through the city council or things like that, we have to go through administrative law judge and produce the sonar and everything else.
Oh. Okay.
Okay.
That's mine.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, then I would move that Senate file 1375 be set aside for consideration for the omnibus state government finance bill.
On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, let me just kind of describe what's going to be happening from here on out. This completes the bills we have for today. There are still some bills that are on our way to us that will probably be referred to us in Monday morning's floor session, and so we will hear some more bills on Monday. Then, after we're done hearing the bills at Monday's meeting, we're going to start looking at our budget bill. And we do have to have it done by Wednesday, so next week we will be finishing our budget division bill. We're not going to close up shop, though, because there's still bills out there around and about that ultimately we have to weigh in on and look at. I'm thinking, for instance, Senator Pappas, you've got a bill in the Rules Committee on an additional member, to the CAP Board. We'll need to look at that. It doesn't affect putting together our budget, it may affect the Senate's budget, you know, and per diem issues and so forth. But, you know, we may have to look at that. Well, I don't need the bill to finish my budget, you know, but I can't get it anyway because it's in the Rules Committee. But at some point, you know, we'll still have other things coming to us, and whether they need to go on my bill or not, I don't know. But I can only deal with the bills that are in the Finance Committee at this particular moment. But we will, we're under a deadline to finish our bill up. As you may know, there's $1 billion of one-time money for the current biennium, which will end on next June 30th. It appears that there's going to be a desire to put about $600 million of it, something around there, into of that one-time money into the budget reserves. That seems to be the proposal that the Finance Committee is going to go forward with. So that leaves about, $400 million or so for one-time money left. The Finance Committee is not going to allocate one-time money out to the budget divisions, none of them. So, for instance, the Senator Rest bill that you just heard, we're not going to get any one-time money targets. All of the budget divisions are being asked to submit their list to the Finance Committee of any one-time money requests. Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, I have a different interpretation of that, and I strongly recommend that you not do lists, that we do bills.
Okay.
I think it's the job of the division chairs to make the tough decisions about what we should fund, and I think you should, even if you have Senator Cohen give you a soft target, I think you should put together a bill spending your priorities that you think should be spent. And if Senator Cohen has to, I mean, you can tell him informally, you know, the order. But if he has to go up or down the list, he can do that, you know, so it gives the finance chair more flexibility. But I really object to this whole process that the bonding committee has been doing about lists. It's not, I don't see where it's legal.
Well, one way or the other, we have to deal with the one-time money issues, however we do it in this budget division. And
we should make the priority decisions.
And we will make our priority decisions within this budget division. So what I'm thinking of doing, and if anybody has a better idea, let me know, I'll have a list of all the issues that have come before us that have one-time money implications, including, by the way, restoration of the Capitol building. That's one-time money. But there's a lot of things. There's a lot of things that we've looked at. Some are probably more important than others, and what I'm thinking of doing is just giving every member of this budget division the list, and we just start ranking. What do you want? What's your personal number one? What's your number two? What's number three? And we'll just total everything on up, and we'll have a sense of where this budget division feels the priorities ought to be. Where, you know, some are there going to be some consistencies. We're going to be all over the map, but I don't know of any other way that we could
Mr.
rank
Chairman,
them.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think, though, it would be helpful that if we had a target. Because if you're going to do a wish list, that's not going to be very helpful.
No, but at
Senator
least...
Senator Rest and I are going to both request the capital remodeling as number one on our list.
Understand. But I think that if we at least... If we at least every member weighs in on the one-time money lists, where you think the important things are, that helps me in advocating where I think we, to the extent there's one-time money, where we ought to put it. Senator Rest.
I think the point that Senator Pappas is making, or as I understand it, is if we just give them a list, then are you on the Finance Committee?
I'm on the Finance Committee, yes.
And you are too. But is anybody else?
No,
here?
It's
yeah,
a small...
Yeah, so the rest of us aren't. And so we give the Finance Committee a list, but we're not part of the decision-making. The Finance Committee, and I'm sure that you would represent the interests and the wishes, you know, the discussion of this division, but it means the Finance Committee will make all those decisions when we don't even know what a target would be for... I think that's the point of the state government finance. And, you know, and I'm on transportation. Senator Olsen is on transportation. Senator Youngbauer, is. And the rest of you are on other finance divisions. And there's a poll there, too. I mean, there's when I think of my own list, okay, the capital is number one, but and I realize that's a really big ticket item, but then the same process is going to be there in transportation and for you in higher ed, and there gets to be a conflict, because if we don't make decisions here, then when the two of you, and I don't know what other finance divisions you're on, Senator Betzel, but when you go to the finance committee, which division are you going to represent, mm-hmm. Senator Pappas? The wish list coming from higher ed or the wish list coming from here?
That's easy for me, because in higher ed we don't have any one-time money.
Well, I know, but...
I know, you get your point.
So I mean, we'll do what the leadership, I guess, the way in which they're going to organize things, but it does seem to be pretty confusing.
I don't see any reason to break from tradition. Traditionally, even if there's going to be one bill, traditionally the budget chairs have put together the bill. And so I think it would be better to put together a committee bill for one-time money, send it to finance, and if Senator Cohen has to make some adjustments, that's his decisions. But we've done our job.
But however you put it together, I mean, I can't put together, I can't just send him a bill with all the one-time money in there.
No.
So that's why I want your input in there as to what you think the priorities are. And we may just decide when we look at the list, there just are some thing one-time issues that probably we should not forward. But I won't know that until I give you the list of everything we've heard, and you know everybody can just vote at what your priorities are. We'll just total them up, and then we'll take a look at where they are, and then we may make adjustments after that. You know,
capital budget aside, do you have any idea how much the requests are for one-time money?
I don't know, Mr. The total of everything is about $300 million, but I don't know how much is one-time. Mr. Lundin, do you know that?
Yeah, I did put together a list. Okay. I did not bring it with me. I mean,
we've got
it's about 15 items on there.
Yeah.
Small.
In fact, no. I think I may have brought here. I think I may. I think he gave me a ton of list. Yeah, it's right here.
Oh, yeah.
Read it through.
Yes, I can read through the list.
Go ahead.
The Senate had a one-time
Excuse
request.
Me, would we be able to get copies?
Oh yeah.
Of that?
I actually can't.
We're not finished with this right now. Okay. But this is the tenor of the list.
Do you
have
that? What's the total?
Well, the total would be about $44 million, and that's before the capital.
Yeah, the capital's not on this list. So.
What?
No, I mean not. You're gonna. It'll be on the list you get Monday, but at least you know he. I asked him to start putting together a list, and this is the tentative list he's got right now. But why don't you just tell us some of the things that we're looking at as one-time money issues?
Okay, some of the one-time things we've heard with the Senate was the technology initiative, which was about $2.5 million. The revisor to complete the bill draft system was $509,000. The legislative training forum we heard today for $20,000. Senator Dibble's bill to end the poverty, that legislative commission was $100,000. Senator Sharon's bill we heard on the absentee voting today was $123,000. The instant runoff voting task force that the Secretary of State presented today is $50,000. Senator Pappas's kids voting bill was $250,000. The targeted group disparity study that the governor recommended in the Department of Administration was $850,000. The Minnesota electronic licensing system that the governor recommended in the Office of Enterprise Technology was $15 million. The MAPS risk mitigation and replacement plan, which the governor recommended in the Department of Finance budget, was $7 million. The Northwest Airlines Bankruptcy Council in the Department of Finance was $315,000. The digital conversion bill of Senator Kubley's for public TV was $14 million. The NPR digital conversion was $3.8 million. The capital area bill that we just heard now was $65,000. The bill that we heard of Senator Scoyes the other day for the Indian burial acquisition was $80,000.
And we may hear some more bills on Monday that have some more one-time money in there, too. So some of these have federal consequences. As an example, the diversity study that has to be done, a disparity study, that's got to be done every 10 years. If we don't do it, we lose federal money. So, I mean, there.
How much was that one?
That was $850,000.
Mr. Chair?
So we'll see.
I think we could almost make a good argument that could be done in-house somewhere.
Well, but those are things we'll look at. But as I say, you know, however we rank them and vote them, and but the decision that's been made at this moment, and Senator Pappas has raised her objections, but they've told me to send something to finance with the one-time items, because the plan at this moment is not to give the budget division's one-time money, to hold the one-time money in the finance committee and let them have a bill that has one-time money expenditures. Now, the Senate can obviously change things down the road. If we decide we don't want as big a budget reserve, we want to change some one-time money, if we decide to change priorities, that can be done. But we've got about 10 or 11 different budget divisions, and they're all converging with one-time money requests, and this is just one budget division. You know, when you look at all the other ones, the big spenders are elsewhere, but they all have their wish lists too. So I don't know how it's going to ferret out. I mean, I'm thankful that actually I've got both me and Senator Pappas on here, but I'm also, for instance, on the judiciary budget one for the courts, and not every budget chair is on there. So Senator Foley, who chairs that, is not on there. So I'm going to get tugged in different directions too. So, but anyway, that is how I'm thinking about proceeding. If somebody else has a better idea, let me know. But at least, you know, we'll have the list for you, the complete list on Monday. You know, we all vote, we all rank them, we'll total them up, we'll see where everybody's at, and if we can want to vote to make adjustments after we've seen, you know, how we're going the list. But to me, we can go either way. We can either send Senator Cohen the list, or we can prepare a bill and send that up to Finance Committee. One way or the other, he's going to get our list, and that's the way it goes. Do you have any questions on the one-time things? Because then we're going to talk about the ongoing part. Senator Kubley.
Yeah, well, just a point of information, Mr. Chair. You know, is the money that we put into the reserve or the rainy day fund, is the interest on that money allowed to accumulate in the rainy day fund, or is that spent? Do you know, or
I don't know how that works.
I think I'd have to check for sure. I guess I don't want to say. I'll double check.
Okay. But the Council on Economic Advisors has recommended that we have about a 5% increase in there, and that would be at least $600 million. In fact, an argument could be made you should put the whole billion in there, but I don't think the Senate's going to go there. But we're going to – and this is higher than what the governor is recommending for the reserves, but the Senate's looking at putting a larger money amount into the reserves and not spending it for the one-time money. If there's no further discussion on the one-time thing, we can look at the ongoing money. Now, for the next biennium, as you know, we have more money coming into the state for revenues than it is the expenditures. Now, that's just a prediction. It's a projection where we're going to be in 2.5 years from now, but that's what the budget forecast said. And then there's probably a downturn in the economy for the next biennium after that. However, you got to deal with the numbers that have been given to us. And there's about more than $1 billion into the ongoing money for the next biennium. Now, every budget division has been kind of given their numbers, including this one. We are the only one that got a cut to the tune of $10 billion. We only got a $600 million budget, but we got a $10 million reduction. Now, that doesn't mean we got to cut things, because we have the base budgets. Now, if you're really in trouble, you do cut into the base. Nobody's suggesting we do that, but we can. You know, we have one ace that we've got, and that was the tax compliance money from the Department of Revenue. So we've got a $10 million deficit to start with. If we spend, I think, about $9 million for the Department of Revenue so they can hire more people. What is it?
10.2.
Then they can hire people to go after people who owe the state money, and that brings in, what, about $50 million? Something like that. So we can dig a hole a little bit deeper, but then we can – and that we count, because that's in our target. So that brings us into the black, you know, by doing that. So not by much, but it helps us. Now, keep in mind, all that does is bring us into the black – before we even spend any money. The governor has recommended a salary supplement to, you know, all the agencies of about 2% for each year. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we can't act in a vacuum on this particular issue, because we can't say nobody gets a pay increase in our area when maybe somebody else gives 2% and somebody else gives 4%. I mean, this has to be coordinated among the budget divisions. there's going to be a salary supplement, it appears. The governor's recommended it, you know, the level of it, you know, we'll see what where we're at, but that's going to eat up a good chunk of the money that we've just found by there. Now, there's a little bit of extra.
What does that cost for our division?
2%
Yes, the 2% that the governor recommended for the biennium was around $12.4 million. The cost of doing the 3.25% will be about $20.3 million.
And they're looking at 3.25% as an increase, as opposed to
2%. 1.25 over the governor. But the governor's cost us $12
million,
yes. And to get to 3.125, whatever it was.
Yeah, there'll be about another $8 million cost.
$8 million, so if we find with the compliance stuff about 40 and you all agree to do the 3.25, then we have less than $20 million to play with.
10 for each biennium probably.
You know, that always baffles me is how they can figure out if we put this much in, we know we're going to get this much back. They have a track
experience.
Record.
Well, yeah, and I've talked to the revenue commissioner the other day about this, and it seems to have worked. However, there's a point of diminishing returns. I mean, the low-hanging fruit from the easy deadbeats who owe taxes, they've gotten that already. Okay.
Before
you could spend a dollar, get 10. Now they're down to spend a dollar, you might get 7 or 6. Yeah. And we could give them $1 billion for tax compliance, but we're not going to get $20 billion back. I mean, it's just they haven't got that many people to hire, and now you're really going after the deadbeats.
Okay.
So they figure that, you know, if we spend the 10, we might be able to get maybe 50 or whatever, but that's as far as they're willing to go, Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, I don't understand. I mean, it's great that they're collecting those tax revenues, but why would they not go into the general fund?
They do, but our part of the general fund that we manage, you know, that's what we get to count for putting our budget together. So we're putting together our, because we have oversight over the Department of Revenue.
So then so. Senator Box talking about this 1099 subcontractor deal where the contractors might have to pay the taxes for the subcontractor. So
he's got to pay for that in his own bill.
Within the tax committee, we have the headquarters in the Department of Revenue. Senator Bach and the tax committee, they're putting together the tax bill to figure out how much taxes do either Minnesotans are going to spend or tax breaks or whatever. And if you're going to give a tax break or collect taxes, you got to balance it out somewhere. They can raise taxes, they can cut taxes, but that is overall tax policy, which is different from running the agency, which is what we have the oversight over.
So that I've heard a number of $600 million possibly, that would just go towards general fund dollars then?
To the extent that you have a tax policy in the state, we know which revenues are going to come in overall based on current tax policy, and they have to figure out if they raise taxes, you get a certain amount of money in. If you lower taxes, you get less money in. But those are decisions they have to make on state tax policy, which has nothing to do with what we're doing here. We're just counting the bodies that work over across the street and say, if you hire some more people and do some more work on tracking down people who owe money, the state gets more money, which has nothing to do with tax policy. This is just money that's owed to the state.
Can we get a copy of that? I'd like to see a copy from them of the exponential growth and decay curve so I can figure out the inputs and outputs.
Yeah.
They do that all the time.
Yeah,
I know we got the information, but I never seen an actual graph, because then you can
also
figure out the actual details of it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, sometimes, though thankfully not this year, there's been a lot of tension between whether the tax committee has jurisdiction over the operations of the Department of Revenue and controls their budget, and because they'd like to spend the compliance money too. But it's really fortunate that here, whether this year, regardless of what's happened in past years, the agency itself stays here. So the compliance revenues, and again, as Senator Betzel said, it's not new money. It's people that owe it already. You know? I mean, in that sense, it's not new tax policy. It's not a tax increase. we get to, the State Government Finance Division gets to do that, rather than it being grabbed by the tax committee, which we would not like.
Thank you.
Now, there's a little bit more wiggle room that we've got, and there might be more, but, you know, we haven't uncovered it. But as an example, with the Dewar merger into the Department of Administration, well, Commissioner Anderson loses her job, so there's a little bit more money that we've got. I think there's probably a few more dollars that are out there, but the fiscal note did not reflect that because they're going to protect what the seven individuals currently endure, and they've promised that they're going to still have jobs. Okay, and Commissioner Anderson is not going to have a job, but there's like three or four other people that are not quite accounted for here. Where are they going to go?
That are not classified.
They're not classified. I mean, are they going to keep their jobs or whatever? But that wasn't part of the deal, so there might be a little bit more money there. But, I mean, we're not talking huge dollars, but there's some things.
$79,000 from her? I mean,
just for one position, that was hers.
Little, yeah. You know, some of those little things, that it's amazing how you can make a good impact on.
Well, and the question is, and I mean, we've approved the bill and sent it to finance, but the question is, if there aren't any real savings in the merger, why are we doing it? You know, so, I mean, but that's a question. But it does, there are no real savings to show up. We've heard about the drive to excellence. And presumably all these things are making government more efficient. But we asked them, okay, how much money are you saving by doing all this stuff? They haven't got any. I mean, I wish I could book some more money on all these savings that they're doing by being more efficient, but they haven't told us that they're doing it. I think they're maybe hiding some money, you know, but you know, I can only work on the fiscal notes that I get. Every governor hides money, every single one. They have to, but it's just for us to figure out. Anyway, so the bottom line. Oh no. Well, you were at Mr. Roebling. You were at the forum when both Governor Cui and Governor Carlson and Governor Anderson. They said, no, we hide money. We do it. We have to. You know, we got to not tell the legislature everything we're doing. So I mean, that's just how it's always done. But anyway, so it looks like from the meager savings we can find and everything we've got, we may have about $10 million for each year that we can deal with. That's something for each biennium. Excuse me, each biennium. So that doesn't go very far. I'll look over the list. I'll have a couple of ideas, and we'll have the whole spreadsheet before you. And on Monday, we'll, you know, when we're done listening to the bills, we'll try to pick and choose what we've got. But you know, it's going to be fairly easy to put this bill together. So we got to make a lot of hard decisions, though. I mean, a lot of folks have been here and presenting good ideas, and we're just going to have to say no to almost every one of them. So, but you know, our other colleagues are, you know, they're complaining they don't have enough money in their budget division. So that's just the nature of the beast here. But we do the best we can with what we got. So. And I'm not having any secret private meetings. I'm just going to roll up, you know, just put things out before you on Monday and say, okay, what do you want to do, folks? And we'll just vote. So any questions or comments? So have a good weekend. So thanks for coming in this morning. And anything else? See you Monday. Have a good weekend.
Don't
thanks
place else
yeah. Meeting adjourned.